Welcome, everyone, to the Grumpy Strategist, the Makers Series, Episode 5. I'm in the chair for a Makers Series for the very first time, which should be fun. And I have with me Rob Kramer. Rob is Director and Defence Sector Lead at Kinexus. So welcome, Rob. Thanks for coming along. Why don't you tell us a little about what Kinexus does and how you got into that business?
G'day, Marcus. Thank you very much for having me. And I really enjoy your podcast series.
Oh, shucks.
Topical and insightful. So thank you for having me. So Kinexus is 23 years old. We're a national defence sector SME. Our main interest is in the workforce space, so we recruit permanent staff, either individually or on a project basis for defence industry. We also provide contractors to both defence industry and direct to government, and we also help companies with their workforce planning and strategy. So we're set up, headquartered in Sydney, but have offices in a few other places around Australia. I get to make my way to Canberra quite frequently, and we work with companies, you know, from the big prime contractors through to SME. So we've got a really good helicopter view on what's going on out there in industry on the workforce supply demand front.
Mm. So the Makers series is essentially about Aussie defence industry, but of course, without workforce, you've got no defence industry. Mm. So you're the guy who basically looks at defence industry, looking at supply, looking at demand, mm-hmm. and trying to align them.
Mm. Yeah, the work that I really love doing is helping defence sector workforce stakeholders, be they industry or government, really understand, you know, the size, composition, nature of the workforce, where the workforce is, what do we need to do to attract, assess, recruit and retain it, sometimes in a very competitive environment. And I love it where I'm able to do that in a way that aligns workforce strategy with defence industry capability outcomes. So I really enjoy helping organisations make educated decisions on those fronts.
So Kinexus is not just about hiring individuals, but helping companies understand the broader demand picture and developing a strategy to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I suppose, where it starts. And we do that quite a grand scale in some instances, but we also really enjoy going in and working with SMEs, and our consultants will go in and help them understand what they need to do to attract and retain a software engineer for an SME for a defence project. So it's really great. Gratifying to use our market insights to help people de-risk their decision making.
Mm-hmm. And like so many people in defence industry, you have a defence and ADF background.
Yes. So it was I was in grade one, so it was 1982. One of the Oberon class submarines was alongside in Hobart, and Dad took me down to see that. And I remember being equal parts terrified and, you know, really amazed and mm-hmm. excited about climbing down into this thing. And so from that point onwards, I wanted to be in the ADF, and particularly the Navy, and the sense of purpose providing security for our country, our way of life, was a real motivator and still is. So I joined the Navy in 1994. I went to the Defence Academy in Canberra, then spent time on patrol boats and guided missile destroyers with a stint over in the UK on exchange, finishing my Navy career instructing what I think are now called maritime warfare officers out at HMAS Watson.
Mm. And so many people in defence industry have that a background like that and are completely committed to defending Australia, like people inside defence. And I think from my experience, people in still in defence lose sight of that. They often see defence industry as, well, I don't want to say bloodsuckers, but I have heard that term. But, you know, in my experience, people in defence industry are just as committed to good outcomes for Australia as people actually serving.
Absolutely. I remember having a completely uninformed negative view of defence industry when I was a junior officer in the Navy. But over the last 20 years working with defence industry, and also having the chance to work with certain adjacent industries, the values that defence industry has broadly and deeply reflect those of the people in uniform. They're not the anybody's money jangles in my pocket sort of values that you will find in some adjacent industries who do compete for our people.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently, the government put out its National Defence Strategy and the supporting Integrated Investment Program, and we learned from that that the government is planning on spending $765 billion on defence over the next decade. We're talking real money now. You'd look at that number and you would go, well, this should be happy times for Australian defence industry. Indeed. Is that the word on the street?
Yes and no. I think if you have a long enough view, then yeah, you can see all these really exciting capabilities being invested in across the domains, but particularly in the naval space. However, when I talk to defence industry, certainly at the moment there's a lot of uncertainty around the investment landscape over the next 12 1 year to 3 years, really. Mm. You know, I think there's still quite a bit to wash through from the budget and the current IIP for SMEs to really understand where they need to invest.
So in the short term, uncertainty. Mm. In the longer term, we have these huge projects.
Mm-hmm.
So we've obviously the nuclear powered submarine program. Mm. There's a Hunter class frigate program. There's going to be the general purpose frigate program.
Mm.
You know, there's other shipbuilding programs in Henderson. When we look at the land space, we've got armored vehicles being made in Queensland and Victoria, and protected vehicles still in Victoria. I mean, a lot of manufacturing going on, plus the whole sustainment space, which we tend to overlook. But when you look at defence's spending, it spends twice as much in Australia on sustainment as it does on acquisition. Yet, you know, sustainment tends to be regarded as the poor cousin. But but anyway, huge demand for skilled workforce. Can we match supply with that demand?
I think if we take the work to the workers, yes. So that's why it's really important for policymakers, for industry to understand where the where the workforce is, its size, its composition. Do we need to do to attract and retain it?
So when you say take the work to the workers, you mean a shipbuilding program in Western Australia may need to use workforce in Sydney.
Potentially. There may be a way of segmenting the work that you need, even just in the production sense, so that you can make the most efficient use of the available labour. And I'll give you an example. You might need the majority of your production labour in WA, but your engineering and, to a degree, some of your project management or corporate services, you might be able to base elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So we've mentioned WA, so recent announcement about the General Purpose Frigate program there, but also late last year, the government announced two landing craft programs. And we also know that Collins sustainment happens there. There's going to be nuclear-powered submarine sustainment happening there. Can that possibly work?
I think it can with some careful planning. Of course, we've had the ANZAC upgrade curtailed, which you'd expect should make a proportion of that production workforce over there available for the projects that you've outlined. So, yes. Where my mind goes, though, is commodity prices. You know, what sort of competition will there be? Because it's, relatively speaking, a small talent pool to feed from, smaller than in places like South Australia. So, yeah, it's going to be a timing issue, and it's going to also depend on what adjacent industry activity is going to present us.
So theoretically, if China stops buying our iron ore, that's good for the shipbuilding industry, but it's also bad because we won't actually have the money to pay for any ships.
Yeah, it's quite the conundrum.
It is a conundrum. So developing that workforce, it seems to me there's a few places it can come from.
Yep.
One is we can poach it from overseas, which is probably challenging because I think some of the kinds of countries we'd like to recruit from are facing exactly the same issues with us. And there seems to be a gentleman's agreement in AUKUS that we won't poach. So limited ability to recruit at scale from overseas. The other one is we train young Australians in the STEM disciplines, but I don't want to sort of be critical of young Australians, but I'm not sort of seeing massive take up in this area compared to historical levels. Yeah, and the third area is we somehow bring people in laterally from adjacent sectors, so their loss is defence is gain. So is there some other way to do it? Because none of those really look like terrifically good paths at the moment, but maybe in combination will it all work, or how do you think it's going to happen?
So immigration's not going to help us. It will to the extent that it might help adjacent industries or reduce the level of competition from adjacent industries as they're able to access skills from overseas. I think that before about 2020, defence industry was very poor at attracting, assessing and recruiting people from adjacent industries. But I think with the Hunter class frigate program, there's been significant hiring from adjacent industries, and quite successfully. When you look at the automotive industry, that housed a lot of really good design engineers, but also reliability engineers, which is a real skill set that defence is craving. And one of the primes hired about 20 reliability engineers and turned them into integrated logistics support engineers, which I think was a fantastic idea and a great outcome.
And part of that big demand driver is, of course, AUKUS, so Pillar 1, a nuclear-powered submarine enterprise, but also Pillar 2, which is a whole bunch of advanced technologies, and certainly, at least in the general public, we haven't gotten too many details around that, but we keep hearing it's all going to sort of take off. Are we starting to see much demand yet from the AUKUS space?
Yeah, so Pillar 1, we're seeing a lot of hiring occur in the Australian Submarine Agency into the public service, which is fantastic to see. And then ASC, I think we can expect a lot of hiring to occur because that they're going to need to ramp up their sustainment workforce, and they're going to be sending...
For nuclear-powered submarines or for Collins?
I'd expect probably both. Now that there's a bit more information out there on the life of type extension, I'd anticipate that ASC would need to expand its workforce to that work, whilst also training up the first generation of people who can sustain an SSN as well. And I think there's been a lot of commentary out there and a lot of intent around sending Australians to the US or to the UK to be trained to sustain a nuclear-powered submarine.
Yeah, I mean, I think ASC and the submarine industry space more generally is in a similar space to the Navy, and that is where we desperately need to keep Collins going. To bridge that capability gap or to stop a capability gap occurring. Meanwhile, we need to be developing our workforce for the new SSN capability, but we don't want it to be poaching from the Collins space. So essentially, we're not just trying to meet the traditional Collins demand, which has been quite difficult, certainly in the uniform space, but now we've got double the demand. So how does that work?
Yeah, it's in the 20-odd years that we've been doing this, we've certainly seen new technology, new platforms being seen as really interesting and attractive work for workforces. So the newer platforms tend to attract workers more and sometimes at the expense of the legacy, the existing platform. So I think that'll be a real challenge for defence and for industry to get right.
I mean, when I look at capability transitions, which is something I have done quite a lot of in this gig, they generally don't go all that well. I mean, the best you can generally hope for is sort of a dip in capability, and generally you're trying to avoid a collapse of capability. But we have had collapses in capability. You know, the transition from the Oberons to Collins, you know, there were periods in there where insiders say we virtually had no submarine capability at all. In our current battlefield helicopter transition, you know, there was a collapse there of virtually no capability from the MRH-90s to Black Hawk. Very concerning situation in our surface fleet with ANZAC starting to be retired, and it's still 10 years from having a Hunter-class frigate that can provide any capability. So I guess we need to really carefully think through that, the submarine transition, because I've written about the Collins Loat, the life of type extension. The bigger you make that, the more resources, including personnel, you are sucking out of the SSN space.
Yeah. One thing I'll say to that is whenever I've had the occasion to go out and talk to engineers, project managers, drafters, schedulers in adjacent sectors, there is a lot of interest in what we do in defence. So I think that if we get our planning right, our messaging right, our offering right, I think that we will attract a lot of already skilled people from adjacent sectors. But we need to get those factors right, of course, and that will require some careful planning and some real investment too.
And the story you just mentioned about people from the car industry, you know, moving over into the Hunter class frigate program does suggest that mobility is possible from adjacent sectors into defence.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. And again, we've seen people move from automotive into land domain as well in Victoria. That's another good example of where that mobility has been successful.
Do people in adjacent sectors understand that?
I would say that there is a low degree of detailed awareness on what we do and how we do it. That's across the population writ large, from the role of the ADF, what we really do, or what the ADF really does. And then when you get into the industry level, there's very low degrees of understanding about what we do in the acquisition or the sustainment space.
So that's an area where the defence sector could potentially improve in getting that message out better.
Yeah, I think there's a big opportunity for that, big opportunity. Having said that, we also, and we have mentioned taking the work to the worker, so understanding where the worker populations are, you still need a nuanced understanding of the composition of that workforce. So, for instance, when you have a look at the software engineers, off the top of my head from some work I've done in the past, about 80% of software engineers in Melbourne were not born in Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a consideration. Many of those are now citizens, but that's a consideration. The opposite is true for the software engineering population in Adelaide or Brisbane, for instance, as well.
Okay.
So it's not just about the overall size of these worker populations. You need to look at how aligned they are to what we need, so they're even suitable, but then to help tune our attraction message as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you hear about the Australian workforce is that it doesn't move geographically. Is that true, or is that an urban myth?
Well, one of the first things I do when I talk to an American coming to Australia, particularly to set up an organisation, is that the Australian workforce is very immobile, geographically speaking. People would rather work in different industries than move to stay in defence. Ties to family, community, etc. are stronger, and we've seen examples where defence industry employers have put significant resource into offering people relocation packages when work dries up in a particular location, only to experience a very, very small uptake rate.
So that would suggest that the idea of taking the work to the workforce is something we really need to be taking very seriously.
It needs to be one of the central tenets to our workforce strategy.
So the broad message I seem to be getting from you is there's reasonable grounds for optimism. Is that correct?
In opportunity for defence industry and to access workers, I believe so. However, the opportunities are great where if you look at AUKUS Pillar 1, AUKUS Pillar 2, look at the priority capability areas, defence industry development strategy, we need to be smart about where we invest in our workforce. We shouldn't look to try and be all things to all people. Look at where we can really add value in the R&D, in the design, in the manufacture, in the sustainment spectrum of given capabilities or within industries, and work with our AUKUS partners on that front to understand where we can add value. And if we are smart in that, and then we understand, right, well, where are those workforces or potential workforces, then we can set about engaging with those workforces, be they people still in the education sector, or they be, you know, at the university R&D level, or their existing industrial capabilities in adjacent sector.
Mm. I guess when I look at the broader defence industry space, my view is your defence industry needs to kind of match your broader industrial base to get maximum value from it, and it's because it's the broader industrial base that we truly need to be leveraging. And in my view, big mega projects in shipbuilding are probably not necessarily our strength. So even if it's possible to set those projects up and deliver, to me it's maybe not the best use of our resources, you know. And I don't sort of need you to declare your hand there and say that SSN program's a waste of space, but in your view, where are the strengths of the Australian industrial base that we can be leveraging?
Industrial base? Well, we've certainly got the skills in the sustainment space across several different capital intensive safety critical industries that we can repurpose, but of course that's a bit of a no-brainer in that, you know, you need to have that sustainment capability here. When you look at across the R&D, so the product development and the manufacturing part of the industry, it's looking at anything that's software enabled. We've got, you know, very good innovation, very good R&D, particularly in the tertiary and university sectors, capabilities that with the right investment could really get some good force multiplication going on there as far as defence industry capability goes. And of course, as a chief engineer once said to me, albeit from a systems integrator, you know, he pointed out that almost every system out there is software enabled now. So that's something where our high degrees of education, our high and proven skill at innovation and R&D could, you know, we could really get a good return on our investment. Can we do the same in cutting steel? We probably don't have the same competitive advantage there as as with other nations, as we might do in sort of those more technology focused spaces. But I also understand the, you know, the strategic reasoning behind being able to develop and retain a shipbuilding, you know, the ability to weld stuff together as well. So it's not a black and white response. Sorry, Marcus.
No, look, nothing is ever black and white. And, you know, governments sort of like being able to announce these big projects and point at shipyards and places with lots of, you know, orange and lime green high-vis vests. But I do have this concern that those kind of projects are sucking lots and lots of really smart, capable people out of other sectors and out of other parts of the defence industry where they could actually be delivering outcomes much faster.
Yes, and there are certainly, we expect that there's going to be a lot of investment in the renewable space, which again is an adjacent and sector to some of the work that we do in defence. But there are efficiencies, I think, opportunities to get some efficiency.
The bottom line is if you have a broader STEM workforce, bigger, more capable, it will benefit defence industry.
Absolutely. If you could change one thing, it would be increasing the output of people with STEM skills from high schools, which would then, in theory, flow into vocational training establishments, flow into universities. That would be the magic outcome.
So this is one of those sort of hot button issues: does everybody need a university degree? Have we got that right? Are too many people getting, you know, university degrees as opposed to trade qualifications?
That's an excellent question. One of the primes I know that over the last 1 to 2 years has been investing in, for want of a better term, like a cadetship type program. So to try and avoid the need to put somebody through a 3 or 4 year degree to get them working as a graduate. So I don't believe everybody does need a degree, but also there've been we need to be pragmatic and realistic about the amount of training that you do need to be useful as well. The defence industry, the defence sector is quite conservative, and how that presents in workforce development is that at the hiring manager level, be it in public service or out in industry, is that hiring managers can be reluctant to hire people in with different skills and experiences because they may not feel like they have the permission, or they don't have the risk appetite, or they don't have the resources to do so, because it can, you know, sometimes that comes with a training liability. But there's an absolute imperative for us to culturally change and shift our approach in that regard. We need to be comfortable hiring people with different skills, hiring people with different experiences, and having the permission and the resources to integrate them into our workplaces.
So really there's two sides to this of broadening the defence industry workforce. One is getting people outside defence industry in adjacent or even not particularly adjacent sectors to be aware of defence industry and be interested in working in it. But it's also defence industry needs to be open to hiring people from outside.
Absolutely. It's some of that's cultural, some of it's practical, and it would be great to see industry and government and defence working together on this, understanding that presents challenges as well as opportunities, understanding what those challenges are and working together to mitigate those.
So is government helping in this space? So you hear a lot of stories about security clearances and it takes too long and that's a real impediment to bringing people over. There's now the SAMS legislation, so the Safeguarding Australia's Military Secrets legislation that Michael and I have spoken about before, that seems to be creating uncertainty. Again, are we heading in the right direction in terms of lowering bars to bring in a broader workforce into the defence space, or are we discouraging them from doing that?
It'll be interesting to see how far outside of the defence sector the knowledge of the SAMS requirement goes. I would not expect that would help us attract talent, but to the degree to which I'm uncertain. The thing that where my mind goes to on this is the moratorium on hiring ex-ADF or APS personnel. So
So they need a 12-month kind of cooling-off period in a sense.
Yep. Yeah, and I understand the rationale, as I understand it, is that, you know, defence doesn't want industry poaching its people, and fair enough. fair enough. However, what that will be doing, what that does in practice, and we see this in our business, is that there are people who want to exit defence for very legitimate reasons, and it's as is their right as well under the, in a way, the social contract that, that defence has with the Australian population, that they are being prevented from transitioning out because they are unable to secure the type of employment they are suited for, or they are leaving the sector.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, I'd be really worried that that might be a bit of an own goal.
Okay.
Over the longer term, because that might affect people's willingness to join defence or the APS, because they might see their restrictions as being mm-hmm. being limiting for them. Yeah, I would love defence to take an approach to recruitment on being, don't buy and hold, but buy and or bring a workforce in, recruit, train you, and if you want to leave us with a skill and experience and move into the greater defence enterprise, that's fantastic.
Mm.
Or if you want to, if we are going to upskill you and you move into an adjacent sector, that's fine. We want to. I would love to see defence pulling people in with a promise of giving them opportunities and options after defence, not just bring them in and try and keep them. It's, we'll give you something. We'll give you these amazing opportunities. And should you stay in defence or the broader defence enterprise, fantastic. And that is good for defence capabilities, but it's also good for the nation.
Well, I think that's a really good point to end on. So a very hopeful, positive note there. So thank you very much, Rob, for coming in and sharing your insights with the Grumpy Strategists.
Marcus, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.